Hello. My name is Sue G, and I am an alcoholic. Now, can I just stand here and look at y'all? I'd rather do that. Because you are real pretty. And isn't it amazing? I would never, ever, ever have had the opportunity to even look at one of you if we all hadn't been old drunks. Isn't that funny? We're all different walks of life, all different people. And there is so much love among us, and we would never even cross each other's paths if we hadn't been old drunks. I am so grateful I was an old drunk and I got the opportunity to know you. My sobriety date is February the 4th, 1973. And I wish I didn't have to say a thing to you except what has happened to me since then. But there's some awfully pretty young faces out there. And I know a lot of you are looking at me right now and saying, if I was that damned old, I'd quit drinking too. But I looked like you one day, and I wasn't this damned old 28 years ago. And I just think how much of a life that if you just hear me, I cry for you as much as you could ever cry for yourself. Because I've been there, done that, and I know that. I love you with everything there is in me to love. And there's not one thing in my life that's ever been given to me that I wouldn't so freely give to you if you would let me. But you have to let me. You have to want it. Just like reading in the 12 steps. If you've got to be willing to go to any lengths. I have been on a journey that's indescribable and unbelievable. It's so elusive, but it is so attainable. And I can stand here right now, which is very unfair of me, to stand here and tell you how happy I am and how good my life is today and everything. But young people, it took me 28 years to get just exactly where I am tonight. I was not here 28 years ago when I had my last drink. But the journey has been so fantastic that I absolutely do not like to tell you anything but the fantastic part of my journey. But that's not fair to you either. So the main thing that I really think that I have to do, and what I say here tonight is my opinion and mine only. It has nothing to do with AA. It has nothing to do with nothing except just me and my feelings. My journey would have, I can't explain it. I can't even tell about it because you have to live it in order to know it. But I can't stand here and tell you how wonderful life is. And how sweet AA is and how good it's been to me and everything. And how it has worked in my life without first telling you what I had to do to get it to do that. Because that's kind of like reading the... At a lot of meetings, they read the promises when there's brand new people there. Well, the promises come later on down in your sobriety after you've got around into the ninth step. And some of these poor people go around wanting the promises Thursday. They don't know that they come with a condition that you've got to do a little something before they come true. And what I would like to do tonight is tell you, I've got to relate to you as an alcoholic because I could stand up here and not say nothing about my drinking days and you'd say, well, I don't know whether she ever had a drink or not. I had my first drink in 1946. I had my first baby and only baby in 1946. My father was an alcoholic and he died drunk when he was 60 years old. I vowed that I would never drink, that's one thing I would never do. In my younger days, I didn't drink. All my morals were just exactly where they're supposed to be. And I had a drink in 1946. World War II was, I won't tell my age too before I get down from here. Bitchy. World War II was over, and my first husband come home from the Navy, and he was a sailor, and everything they ever said about sailors was true. And he drank. And we lived in Gallatin, Tennessee at the time. And we belonged to a square dancing club out at the VFW club. And he went to Hawk Carter's. I hope he's dead now or something. I just called his name. But he was a bootlegger. And he went out there and got a bottle of whiskey, and it made me mad. And I told him, I said, every time you take a sip, I'm going to take one too. And I did. I got drunk. And I had a blackout. And I found out I was pregnant, and I got scared, and I got sick and all that good stuff that night. And from then on until I had my last drink, I can't ever remember drinking without getting drunk or looking forward to the weekends or whatever when I could drink. I'm not one of these alcoholics that was unloved, unclaimed, unwanted, or didn't achieve. I was an achiever in school and everything else. I'm not that kind of an alcoholic. And I didn't drink because I was lonely or miserable or mistreated, unhappy. I drank because once I picked one up, I had no power over not picking up another. And I drank for 27 years like that. And I cannot give you one reason for my drinking except I'm an old drunk. Once I pick up a drink, I cannot stop. I can't give you another reason. And I know today that once I pick up a drink, I will not stop. That's the only thing that keeps me from picking it up. I never did like the taste of booze, and I never did like the smell. I just like the effect. And the first time I thought about I had any problems from it, I had a daughter, and we lived down on Lock 4 Road in Gallatin, right off Gallatin Road in Gallatin, Tennessee. And my husband traveled. I got in the habit of taking a bottle of vodka home every night. I think it was a half a pint. I'm not too sure. I'd drink half of it, give my little five-year-old daughter a bath, put her to bed. I'd drink the other half, and then I'd go to bed. So I remember one night, I remember drinking half of that vodka. I woke up the next morning sitting in my driveway. There was a fifth bottle of whiskey sitting on the seat beside me, and it was empty. And I did not know where my daughter was, and it was about 9 o'clock the next morning. And it had been about 9 o'clock that night when I had thought I put her to bed. And I didn't. I don't know whether I did till today or not. But it scared me. But I didn't think about stopping drinking. I didn't think about my drinking being what caused that. But see, my husband traveled all the time, and I thought, well, if he didn't travel and wasn't waiting home all the time, I wouldn't need that booze at night because I'm afraid to stay by myself. And when I drink that, I'm going to sleep. See, excuses. But that day I went out, and I hired a girl to come and live with me and my daughter. And from that day until my first marriage broke up, and my daughter married at the age of 19, my life became everything that I had ever believed in or ever thought was right. I did it wrong. I became everything that I hated and disbelieved in, and I couldn't help it. If I wanted it, I got it, and I didn't care who I walked on or who I hurt to get it. In 1964, my first husband and me, my daughter had married, my first husband and me divorced, and I was talking to my sister in Indianapolis, Indiana, and she said, I must have drove her crazy because she asked me to come up there. I guess I was talking to her drunk on the phone, and she said, Sue, there's something real bad wrong down there. Why don't you sell out down there and come to Indianapolis? You and me have never been close for several years now because I've been up here and you've been down there. You've got nothing to hold you there now because Brenda's married. And she said, sell out down there and come to Indianapolis. Well, I called Frankie Hooper and told her that she'd have my beauty shop for whatever she wanted to pay me for it. I called my daughter and I said, just back you up a truck. You can have all the furniture. Because you can't afford to furnish that little house the way you want to. And I sold everything, or I traded everything that I had ever loved, needed, or wanted. And stopped at the last chance liquor store. And got a bottle just about that high, a fifth of Dark Eyes vodka. I traded everything I ever had for that bottle of Dark Eyes vodka. Got a trailer, U-Haul trailer, and put an old television and a lamp. That's all I took. And that fifth bottle of vodka. And I headed out for Indianapolis, Indiana. And I never will forget, I was scared. I had never driven that far by myself. I had a 64 Chevy 2. This was in June of 1964. Excuse me. And I laid that bottle down on the seat beside me, and they didn't have seat belts for kids back then like they do now. And every time I'd have to step on the brakes or something, my bottle would kind of act like it's going to come out in the floor. I'd put my hand out and catch it like you would a child. And I'd say, you're okay, baby. I did that bottle that way all the way to Indianapolis, Indiana. And do you know, till today, I don't remember drinking it. I think my sister took it away from me when I got there. Because she told me later on, every time she'd catch me with booze, she'd take it away from me. And then she's in the program now. And she told me all that booze she took away from me, she took home and drank it. I've been thinking about getting her on one of them judge shows to pay me back for my booze. Judge Joe Brown or some of them. And but I went to Indianapolis, Indiana with that fifth bottle of Dark Eyes vodka. And I went to work. I've never been out of work. I mean, so for some reason or other, somebody told Mr. Van one time that I was drunk on the job. He said, shut your damn mouth. You can do a better job drunk than you can sober. So I guess I was one of them alcoholics that if I run out of alcohol, I was like an automobile that run out of gas. I just didn't function. But I went to work in Van's Beauty Salon in the Roosevelt Building. And I functioned. And I met a man, another man. And every day at 6 o'clock, he'd call me. And I met him in a tavern. And he was asleep on the bar when I met him. And me and Mary Frances, we roomed together. And she worked at RCA and I worked at Vans. And when we went out one Saturday night and we was having fun, we was at the Macabob. I don't guess anybody knows that. But that's out on a strip now. It was then, but I didn't know. I didn't care, don't guess. And so we went out. She said, Sue, get up and dance. I said, Mary Frances? I said, there's not but one man in this place that I would give the time of day. And I don't know why it was that old white-haired man asleep over there on the bar. And I said, it's that old white-haired man over there asleep over there at the bar. She says, well, I'll get him over here. I said, no, you won't. Well, he roused up sometime after a while. And my seat at the table where I was sitting was close to the door to the men's restroom. And I knew that as much beer as he was drinking, he was going to have to go to the bathroom. And when he got up to go to the bathroom, I scooted my chair where he couldn't get the door open. And he couldn't get the door open. He says, lady, he says, I'm not trying to get fresh. And he said, I'm not even going to ask you to dance, but can I go to the restroom? And then I said, yeah. And he said, well, you look lonely and I am too. And I asked him to sit down. And he said, I know Wayne didn't ask me to dance. He can't. He couldn't. We lived together 30 years and he never did dance. But that man came into my life and every day at 6 o'clock, I would get just right like this. And everybody, even me, we thought I was that much in love with that white-headed man. He had the prettiest curly white hair you have ever seen. Until this day, I love white hair. And he called me at 6 o'clock, and I'd get just right like this. And everybody thought I was that crazy over him, and I did too. But it wasn't that. He'd pick me up at 6 o'clock. He'd take me to Rosen's Tavern on Massachusetts Avenue. B would set me down 3 Blatt's beers. I don't know whether any of y'all ever drank Blatt's or not, but that was the going thing in Indianapolis. And I would chug lug them 3 beers just fast as I could drink them, while the rest of them was just drinking normal. But I thought I deserved them. I'd been working on them hateful old women all day long. I didn't see a thing wrong with that. Well, I started getting fat and got putting on a lot of weight. Well, I thought it was drinking the beer, so I went back to vodka. And I started getting physically sick, and I went to the doctor, and already in there somewhere, me and Russell got married, because he was paying rent, and I was paying rent, and we was both drinking, and we married. We figured this one out. We're smart. We figured out that if we got married, that we'd just pay rent in one place, and we could drink more. We'd have more money to drink on. So, well, we got married, and I started getting physically sick, and went to the doctor, and he said, "How much do you drink?" I said, "Oh, anywhere from a half a pint to a pint a day." By now, I was getting up every morning, drinking 4 Russell's beers. I'll tell you why I drink them beers. My husband's name was Russell. One morning, I got up. He took the car, and I had to ride the bus. One morning, I got up and got on the bus to go to work. I fell out of the seat of that bus down in that floorboard 4 times. And I found out that if I drank 4 of his beers before I go on that bus, I could sit on that seat. And from then on, that's what I did. I drank them 4 beers. I went down to Capitol Tavern. I got some mixed drinks down there, my vodka and stuff. I bought me another little bottle, put it in my pocketbook, and took it back up to Vans to go to work. I'd done that for a long time, but I told that doctor I drank anywhere from half a pint to a pint a day. Now, but I was doing all this, and that's what I told him. So he said, "Well, I suggest you cut down to a couple of highballs every night." I did. I drank the rest all day long, just like I'd been drinking. And when Russell got home that night, he worked at the airport, and I always got home first. When he got home that night, I made him watch me. In other words, I used to say, I made him eyeball my highballs. I made him watch me drink them highballs. And I would swear to God that's all I'd had all day long. But this went on till I got sicker and sicker. And finally, I weighed 210 pounds. And I was when I sat down, I didn't have no lap. I looked like a watermelon with 4 toothpicks stuck in it. And that's exactly what I looked like. And I didn't have no features in my face. It was all, I was bloated. And I had to go back to the hospital, and the doctor put me in the hospital for 7 days, and he said, "I'm not trying to scare you," he said, "because you can't scare an alcoholic." I said, "You just can't scare a what?" He said, "An alcoholic." I said, "You calling me an alcoholic?" He says, "No, but if you're going to ever drink anymore, don't come back to me." And he said, "You've got cirrhosis of the liver. You don't have but 40% of your liver left. And you got something, some rare blood, something in my blood." And he said, "If you're ever going to drink anymore, don't come back to me." Well, all of my drinking days, and I think most of us, had always said, "I make my own money, I buy my own booze, and when you start making the money and buying the booze, you can tell me when and how to drink it. I can quit any time I want to." I have said that a million times. I can quit any time I want to. Well, I'll tell you, folks, I went home that day when that doctor told me that I did not have over 10 months to live. And I knew from the condition that I was in that there was something wrong. I went home that night and I tried. I'd honestly tried to not drink. Well, I went into convulsions and I went into DTs and I went into seeing things and hearing things. And the last thing I remembered that day, I was screaming. I knew I had to drink. I no longer had a choice. I no longer had a choice. My sister, from that day till I had my last drink, I can't stand here and tell you that I am can honestly telling you the truth. I have to tell it to you as it has been told to me. For the next 2 years, I cannot remember 24 hours put together. I just had pieces and bits of my life. My sister has filled me in on part of the stuff that I'm going to tell you. When I found out that I had no choice, I could not drink. I never drank another drop. I lost my desire to drink that day. I never drank another drink that I wanted. Every drink I drank from that night till I had my last drink was because I had to have it. If you've not been there yet, young people, please listen to me. Please listen to where it took me. Please don't waste your life. Please don't waste your future marriages, your future children, and all the future that you could ever have. Because the time does come, and it will come, that you do not have a choice. And then your living hell will start. And you will get to the point of where you will be afraid of living and afraid of dying, but more afraid to keep on living than you are of dying. And if you do what I did, you will try suicide, and you might not be lucky enough to die. I wasn't. If you're not there yet, you don't have to go. You don't have to pick up another drink if you really, really don't want to. On February the 4th, 1973, every human being on the face of this earth that I knew was done with me. They was through. I had nobody left. I drank everybody up. They could not bear to look me in the face anymore. My husband called my brother and told him I was killing myself and he couldn't do anything about it. He said, leave her, and he did. My daughter had called me up, knowing I was drunk. She said, Mama, she says, I love you, but I hope and pray that the next time I lay eyes on you, it's in a casket. I can't take this any longer. But yet, independent me, I didn't hurt anybody but myself. My drinking did not hurt anybody else. On February the 4th, I called my mother. I know I intended to ask my mother to let me come home. But I don't know what I said to her, but I remember what I made my little mother say to me. And I was her firstborn. There's mothers and fathers out there. I don't have any idea what my child or your child would have to say to you to make you say to them what I made my mother say to me. But my mother saved my life by saying it. She says, I put up with 40-some-odd years of that from your father. He's dead. And since he's died, I've been living a little bit. And she says, frankly, I don't care if you lay there on that floor and die and go straight to hell. And she hung up on me. I called my cab driver, which for a year I hadn't walked. I had a cab driver bringing me my booze because I had to have it. And I called the cab driver. He brought me a bottle of Librium because somewhere along the line that doctor thought Librium would help. He brought me a bottle of Librium and 6 pints of vodka. And I think my sister says this was on a Friday. On a Monday, her and her husband got the police to break the door down to get in the house. I was laying in my own filth. If it was inside me, I was laying in my floor in it. My sister says that for the last 15 months, I had been bleeding from every hole in my body. 5 times she had rushed me to community hospital, hemorrhaging from the nose, the mouth, the rectum. She told me that. I don't know. She told me what, and I was laying in my own filth. The bottles were laying there empty, and I wasn't dead. I don't know. I am so grateful today, though, that I got to my depths before AA, because I have not had to experiment all that yet. And I said, yet. When I came to and I wasn't dead, I cannot explain how I felt. I felt that I was in this world of, this is the best way I know how to put it. I felt like I was in this world completely and nothing else in it but me. I was in a dark void, going down a dark tunnel that was big at the top and it was getting smaller as I went. And I could not reach out in any direction and touch anything or anybody. To me, that was the depths of loneliness. I've not been that lonely since. And unless I get that lonely again, I won't be unhappy again. My sister came, her and her husband. We got the police to break the door down. She called the doctor. He wasn't in. Thank God. She got me out of the floor on the couch. She says, I'm going back home and get my kids to school. They get their lunches and get them back to school, and I'll be back. The doctor will be in after 11 o'clock. Well, she happened to leave my telephone books laying on the couch beside me. And there was a telephone number on that book. And so help me God, it might have been the way my mind was or the way things were, but that telephone number was giving it this. Just like it was beckoning me to dial it. And I just thought, well, that doctor's told me if I'm going to drink, he's not to come back, and I can't not drink. And I thought, well, I'm going to call that telephone number. And I called that telephone number, and it was my sponsor till this day. She said that I had called her, and I didn't know it. And I've heard people say since I've been in this program, well, if they're drunk, don't talk to them. If you can talk enough to make me hear you, I'll listen. If they hadn't listened to me, I would not have made it. I don't care how drunk you are. If you're on that phone calling me, you're asking for help. Now, that's my own opinions. Now, I told y'all a few minutes ago, my opinions are my opinions. And I've been living ever since that day, people. This is where the good journey starts. It's just like I have got a car that's on automatic, and I can't even turn it the wrong way anymore. I can try, and then something says, well, girl, you don't do that. Well, girl, you don't do that. And it has been so wonderful. I've been on a journey that it's been uphill, it's been downhill, and I went to Fairbanks Hospital that same day. Mary Jane got me in Fairbanks Hospital, and she said, I'm going to be your sponsor. I said, okay. I didn't know what a sponsor was. So, well, they tied me down for 5 days and 5 nights. They said, I don't know. I don't remember that. And but I remember the first meeting I went to. I'd been in, they let me out of, I thought I was in a restaurant, and the maitre d's was working behind locked doors. I kid and say they let me out of the restaurant's locked doors. They let me out of the the locked doors. And on Friday night, they let me go to an AA meeting. That's my first one. And I don't know, as women, we feel pretty. You know, you can take a man out here, and he can go out here and get drunk, tie one on, and everybody, ho, ho, he throwed one on last night, didn't he? And you let a woman do the same thing. Did you hear what that slut done last night? She neglecting her children. I bet you they're at home by themselves. You know, but he goes out and has a good time. It's okay. I ain't got nothing against you, man, but that's just the way society does a few things. But anyhow, that makes us women feel a little bit less than. And I went to that Friday meeting and felt a whole lot less than. All them women in there, now you ain't going to tell me that these women are alcoholics, that these women get drunk, that these women don't go to church every Sunday because they're too dressed up, they're too clean. And I wanted to just crawl under that table. And I sat there for an hour and 15 minutes. And I got something, and it took me quite a while to know what I had. But I've held on to it till this day. And that was hope. Hope is very, very important to get. I had been, remember I told you that everybody I loved had told me they no longer wanted to associate with me any way, shape, form, or fashion. I sat in an AA meeting for an hour and 15 minutes, and that's how long it lasted. And I knew before I left there, I knew that these people understood, that these people wanted me, honestly, wanted me and accepted me for the because I was what everybody I'd ever loved and wanted had kicked out. Now, if you can think of any greater love than that, I wish somebody would tell me where it is. We love each other because there doesn't have to be a reason. We don't have to know whether you're worth anything or not worth anything. Ain't no big shots or little shots in this program. One shot and we're all shot. But I want to tell you something right now. I can stand here, you know, I've heard people say, well, God never talks to me, and I never see God. Well, I do. This room, and I don't have many people here, but every eye in this room tonight that is looking at me has got more God coming out of them, for me, this is just me, than most people will ever have the privilege of seeing in a lifetime. Because I can stand here tonight and tell you that one of the greatest releases outside of being released from alcohol itself is all my life, year after year after year after year, I would, you gotta love me, you gotta love me, you don't love me, you do love me, you don't love me, you gotta love me. But now you can't love me enough, because if you do, I'll kill you. And then somewhere along the line, this program has, I didn't work the steps, I didn't have sense enough to work the steps. I learned to live the steps. I had a sponsor that taught me how to change, which is the most important thing we can do in what it's all about. To me, is change. She taught me how to change. Each one of these steps was change, change, change. And by the time I realized what I was doing, it had already seeped in. And I didn't know it. And that's the way this program's happening. But it has seeped into me when I didn't know it. I did not know it. She told me, put good orderly direction into your life. I said, well, what is good orderly direction? She said, well, watch me do what I do. That's simple, ain't it? Watch me do what I do.
I'd say, well, my husband's doing this, 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 this. She wouldn't tell me to kill him or divorce him. She'd say, pray for him. I'd say, okay, God help that son of a bitch. She told me to do it. And he'd say, what'd you call me? I'd say, Mary Jane told me to do it. One time I made her mad about something. And she looked at me. See, I was up north. And I never did lose my southern accent because I really didn't want to. And I done something, and she got mad at me. She said, you little southern aristocratical bitch. I'd rather see you sober any day than have you for a friend. And it made me mad. But I went home that night and got thinking about it. I thought, I've never been loved that much before. She didn't care what happened to our friendship. She knew I was nothing if I didn't stay sober. My sobriety meant more to her than ever having a friend. And I'd never been loved that much before. And from then on, I've been listening to her ever since. She's still my sponsor. And will be as long as she lives. But I have had so many fantastic things happen to me in my sobriety because I am so grateful today that I went as far down as I did. And I hope that I can stand here and tell some people how far I went. And I hope that you'll check yourselves if you're, say, in your late 20s or early 30s now and see where I went. And realize that you don't have to go there. But I have had some miracles, really, really, really miracles, happen in my life over and over and over again. And I never really know how this program is going to take part in my life until something happens. The first thing that happened, my grandson, when he was 21 months old, was kidnapped. And I had saved by that time, and he's 23 years old now. That's quite a while ago. By that time, I had saved $1,500. I was going to build me a room on the back of my little house. Well, private detectives had to be paid before they'd start looking. I let that money go to get that to give to the private detectives on a Thursday. On a Sunday, they was out in the boondocks at Temple Terrace, Florida, with my grandson in their arms. I let go, and I got back. The next thing, my daughter had a hysterectomy. Well, I don't know if it was the next thing or not, but it was. I'm just picking out a few things because I can't talk all night. What time am I supposed to quit? My daughter had a hysterectomy, and she's had a history of cancer, and she didn't come out of it for 3 days, and they put me a bed in the room with her, and I stayed in there with her, and they said she wasn't going to come out of it. She's going to stay in a coma. And on the third day, I was sitting on the bed with her, not on my bed, but beside her bed, and I was holding her hand, and all of a sudden, I felt relief, and I felt guilty because I felt relief. I felt an ungodly relief, and I just looked at her, and I said out loud, I said, God, 40 years ago, when she had cancer the first time, they told me she couldn't live over 6 months, I asked you to let me keep my baby, and I said, you did. I said, in that length of time, I have done everything against you that I could possibly do. Yet you've let me keep her. You've let her give me 3 more. I do not have the courage to ask for any more. If it's your time for her, take her and give me the courage and the strength. And at that minute, that girl squeezed my hand and said, Mama. And she's been in remission ever since. And now she has 3 grandchildren, which are my great-grandchildren. I had a heart attack in 1994. And everybody thought I was going to die and leave my husband. My husband wasn't healthy. And I did too. Well, in 95, my husband went and had his chest x-rayed, and he had the fast lung cancer. In June of 96, he was operated on, and in October 96, he died. I'm the one who was supposed to die, not him. And my husband died October the 21st, 1996. My father died October the 21st, 1969. And at the same time my husband was dying, Steve's first grandchild was being born. She was born that day. I don't know if that's got anything to do with each other or not, but I got a feeling. I don't know. It makes me feel pretty close to the child. But, and then this last thing that I don't understand, and I'm going to tell this and then I'm going to quit, because you can read the big book and you can figure these things out for yourself, and you can go to meetings and you can, and if you don't get the first step, you'll never get none of the rest of them. The first step tells you plainly, if you don't lose all reservations that you can safely drink, you will. That's the bottom line. That's my opinion. Because if you think that you can safely drink, you will. And if you don't admit completely that you can't do it, you might as well not try the rest of the steps, because you're not going to change enough to make it. And spirituality, to me, read the last appendix in the big book, next to the last appendix. I used to think that spirituality was this guru something somewhere, you know, out of sight and out of reach and everything, but it's, to me, it's not. Spirituality is personality change and your outlook on life and good orderly direction you put in your life. That's where I get my spiritual growth. The greatest release that I've ever known in my entire life was, I can stand here now and look at all of you faces. And I don't think you have any idea how beautiful you really are. There is nothing on this earth that's any more powerful and any more beautiful than you are right now. You don't know me, and I don't know you, except I know basically the biggest percentage of us are alcoholics, or we wouldn't be here. But you know something I know? I love you, and ain't a damn thing you can do about it. You can't do, say, think, or feel anything to make me not love you. And if you don't think that makes me feel good, try it. You'll like it. But I do know that you do love me back. And I do know that some of you young, I do know that some of you, even the biggest percentage of you, are not going to make it yet. But I hope and pray that I've stood here long enough tonight to plant a little mustard seed. And even if it takes 10 or 15 more years for it to grow, I sincerely hope it does. But don't forget, you've got the seed. It's up to you to grow it. If you want what we have, you have to be willing to come and get it. And people say it's so easy. I've not had an unhappy day sober. Now, I don't mean by that it's been ha-ha party time. But my journey through this life, for a whole generation, I've been reincarnated and didn't have to die. And if this is as close to heaven as I ever get, I have been rewarded much more than I ever deserved just by having the privilege of standing back here tonight. I don't know whether I've helped one of you tonight or not, but I know that every one of you have helped me. And I know that I've been allowed to stand behind this podium and try to the best of my ability to pour my heart out to you, to give you what I've got. Laugh at me if you will. Talk about me. But watch me and wish. When my husband passed away, I lived in the house for a while. I had to go through things. My daughter called me. My daughter. I ain't got but one now, remember? She didn't want to see me no way but in a casket. She called me and she said she couldn't stand it. She said, "Mama, I got to get you home." I had another heart attack after he died. "I got to get you home." And I thought, I've not done anything now with her except stay sober. Go to meetings and try to help other people. And now I tell everybody I live in the West Wing of White House. And I do. My daughter, I sold out in Indianapolis. I come down here a year ago last August, October, and my daughter let me build me a little efficiency apartment on the West Wing of her house in White House. So I ain't lying. And and a big old deck and everything. And people think I'm crazy to leave that big old house and everything I had in Indianapolis. But I want you to know, now I don't understand this myself. I do not understand. God has got a sense of humor. I do not understand why I am happier than I have ever been in my life. And I am. That is the honest truth. The best part of my life is yet to come. In December, I had another heart attack. I went to the hospital and had a stent put in this artery. Come home, next day I had another heart attack and had to go back. Had a stent put in my heart. I got 3 stents in my heart, 1 here and 1 here, but I'm happy. I don't see, I'm probably a little bit crazy too. But I know that the longest part of my life is behind me, but the best part of my life is before me. And my name is Sue Gordon, and I'm an alcoholic. If you're ever around White House, Tennessee, my telephone number is 672-7011. And if you call me, I guarantee you, I will talk to you. And if I can't understand what you're saying, I'll say, "Honey, sober up and call me back." So, I wish I had an Aladdin's lamp or something, or Lucky Rabbit or something, so I could rub it. And if I had one wish that I could wish, I would wish that everyone that's in this room tonight could go out of here feeling like I do and never ever have to feel any different. That would be my wish. Because when I stood up here, I was nervous. I ain't shaking now. I was nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. I'm not nervous now because when love kicks in, all else goes. I didn't feel very tall when I first got up here. I didn't feel very adequate in what I was fixing to do. But you know I'm going to sit down now. And I grew. I grew. I'm 10 feet tall right now. And I love you with everything there is in me to love. And I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that whether you want to or not, you love me back. Thank you.